At the age of 32, Simon Rattle is one of today's most celebrated young conductors. Rattle thinks of himself as a monogamous conductor, monogamous to his City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in England. At a time when conductors have become celebrity jet-setters, traveling from one orchestra to another, Rattle has spent the better part of the last 8 years developing his regional orchestra into an internationally acclaimed unit. He does take some time away from Birmingham to serve as the principal guest conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Rattle and his orchestra have been getting rave reviews on their current American tour. They're also known in America for their recordings of works by Mahler, Sibelius, Elgar, and Stravinsky. I spoke with Simon Rattle from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we hear from him, let's listen to an excerpt from his recent recording of Igor Stravinsky's symphony Petrushka. It's an excerpt from Stravinsky's Symphony Petrushka, conducted by my guest Simon Rattle. He's conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. Well, the way you play Stravinsky, I must say, it really swings. What do you think about when you're setting the rhythm?
Well, I just think in that music, the rhythm is absolutely the fundamental of the whole thing. And I started off life as a percussionist, so I suppose there's no real escape from that. And in a way, that style of playing is something that the orchestra has very much made its own. They're set up in some way almost like a big band. We play a piece like Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony, which actually sounds like a Stan Kenton lush arrangement. That's the way they play. So we're all great jazz lovers as well.
Now, you've been conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra for about 8 years, and I understand you've rejected offers from orchestras with higher visibility. What keeps you in Birmingham?
Well, first of all, most important, they're a magnificent orchestra, and obviously one chooses your instrument out of self-interest more than anything else. It's far from being unselfish. We have a fantastic orchestra, and also a marvelous audience which is willing to follow us wherever we may go. And we have a subscription season in Birmingham that's kind of 98% sold out all the time. And it's, in a way, it's just the perfect place to be working. Of course, music is not really like the Olympics. One doesn't get gold stars for visibility or prestige. In a way, one wants to go on making music in the best place possible. The orchestra and I have built it up together. They're a very young orchestra. I mean, really, now almost a majority in their 20s. And in a way, there's no ceiling to what they can achieve.
This is a period when a lot of conductors jet set around the world and, you know, guest conduct different orchestras all the time. Do you have problems with that kind of style?
I just don't think it's very good for music making. It's very good for United Airlines, but otherwise, I think the idea that, you know, if you had a string quartet and the first violin was different every couple of weeks, you'd be really very surprised if it worked efficiently at all. And I feel the same with orchestras. And I realise I'm in Birmingham 5 or 6 months a year, and that is an enormous amount more than the generality of conductors. I mean, I learn even, you know, Sir George Scholte in Chicago is only there for 9 or 10 weeks. I mean, that's not to say anything about that partnership. They're wonderful, but it's still interesting reflection.
Now, did you expect this to be your attitude when you took on the Birmingham Orchestra?
When I took on the Birmingham Orchestra, I was 24, and I was, I mean, just delighted to be offered
anything.
Absolutely, no, a job like that, particularly with a very well respected orchestra. I had no idea how long it would last, and I had no idea what they would decide to make of themselves, because that's, you know, it's very much the orchestra's job. They had come out of a difficult period of their history, and they had decided that they wanted to become a great orchestra, and they set about just doing what they could. So, in fact, the manager of the orchestra and myself were directly elected by them. They took their life into their own hands. So if things are difficult now, I'd kind of look at them and say, well, I'm afraid, folks, it was your fault all along.
Birmingham is an industrial city in England. Is the role of the orchestra different in Birmingham than it would be, say, in a large metropolitan city like London?
It depends. I mean, I'm trying to... Birmingham is the second city in England in the way that, say, Frankfurt is in Germany. So actually, there's rather a lot going on. It's always been the kind of center of commerce. It's also a very large area. So there's a lot to draw from. In a way, I mean, for the arts, it's an extraordinarily lively area because, you know, people play hard there as well. And I found that, in fact, there's probably almost even a more sophisticated audience for music there than in the capital. Sometimes when we play our concerts in London, we find we actually have to water down our programmes for safety.
You mean less contemporary music?
Yes, for instance, or less unusual juxtapositions. Again, we've built up an enormously strong relationship with the audience, so that in a way they're expecting unusual things.
Conductor Simon Rattle is my guest. Now, I know you have guest conducted many orchestras. Do you run into problems not unlike a substitute teacher would run into? And I've substitute taught, so I know what it's like when you're in front of a room of students who don't know you and don't necessarily trust you. I don't know if it's at all like that when you're guest conducting, if people test you like that.
Oh, I think that can be very true, particularly for a young conductor. When I started conducting, I was very used to that. But, you know, now I do very little guest conducting, and sometimes one's still taken aback at people's suspicions, you know, just because I'm not entirely grey, although, you know, it's getting there fast. It can also be, to guest conduct can also be a wonderful thing occasionally, and, you know, one can have a marvellous fling. But, you know, no one's really pretending it's a marriage.
Do you ever have guest conductors with the orchestra in Birmingham?
Oh, of course. I mean, like any other orchestra.
So do you like to hear them? Do you learn new things about your orchestra by hearing other people conduct it?
I love to hear them. And, you know, one of the most mysterious things about conducting is that every conductor makes a different sound out of the orchestra. I mean, even without speaking. As students once, we made an experiment that 10 of us in a row conducted the same 8 bars of music with an orchestra. And we weren't allowed to say anything. We just had to stand up and conduct, and for each conductor the orchestra made a different sound. Now, one can understand that on a piano or a violin, but with an orchestra it seems even more mysterious. And so it's always fascinating, you know, they bring out new facets.
You know, it's interesting to me, you said that most of the members of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra are pretty young, even as young as in their 20s. I guess that was lucky for you in a way, since you were pretty young. You were in your 20s when you took over the orchestra. I think it would have been probably very difficult to be the, quote, boss of a group of musicians who are much older than you were.
That's not necessarily true. musicians want to get on with, they want to get on with their job, they want to make the best possible music. It just depends what their attitudes are. In fact, most of the young people in the orchestra have come in since my time.
Oh, so they were older when you started?
Absolutely. I know, and since I was 24, it wasn't very hard for them to be older.
Right.
It's just a matter of it's a matter of people's open-mindedness.
What did you
But, you know,
to
musicians in their 20s can just be just as difficult and prejudiced as musicians in their 60s, if they care to be.
Was there, like, a testing period where you had to prove yourself?
I think the orchestra wanted to do what they were doing so badly that hasn't really arised. In fact, you know, as a conductor with an orchestra, in a way, we're always proving ourselves to each other. But there's now such a close relationship that there's a great deal that just simply doesn't have to be said than we do by osmosis or whatever.
Now, I understand you hate to be called maestro.
Does. Can you blame me?
No, I really can't. Why do you hate it?
Because I think it places me in another position from the musicians. I mean, in Italy, everybody's called maestro. That's fine. I mean, so are the orchestral musicians. That I don't mind at all. That's somehow a word for musician there. Here it's something to do with social class and status. And, you know, I think to myself, they actually make the music. They play the notes. They're equally and more important.
Do you think this is a generational thing that other young conductors too have rejected that maestro way of addressing conductors?
I think we split into fairly clear halves of the people who can't stand to hear the word and the people who won't turn up unless they do hear the word. So it's interesting. No, I see people of my own generation who still behave as autocratic conductors. I don't know necessarily that it has changed that much. It's a matter of personality. I'd rather try to persuade than force.
You grew up in Liverpool. Now, for Americans, Liverpool was put on the map by the Beatles. Did the Beatles' music affect you at all when you were growing up?
Well, it was all happening in Liverpool all at the same time. And it hardly did, because almost to keep my nose above water, I really didn't listen to it much as a kid. It was only when I was at music college in my later teens that I realized how marvelous it was.
How did you escape hearing it?
Well, you know, obviously one heard it. It was around, but I didn't make much of it. I was involved in everything else. I also loved jazz, which was even more unfashionable then than it is now. And so it took me a time to come to it. You know, I realize now that, in fact, that was one of the great songwriting teams of the century. But I never saw them, even though I lived just right by Penny Lane. It's hilarious. I even went to the hairdresser that's mentioned in the song Penny Lane. So. Time goes.
So you listen to a lot of jazz. How do you think jazz has affected your conducting?
Only in terms of rhythm and in terms of improvisation,
mm-hmm.
in that way. It's interesting because, you know, when I started, I played a lot of Baroque music as a teenager. I played harpsichord a great deal, and jazz is probably closer to Baroque music than anything else, because there's still the same kind of freedom of improvisation there. But, I mean, for me, it's all music. A whole lot of us in the orchestra, in fact, about 40 of us last week, went to hear Dizzy Gillespie play in Washington. And I think, you know, we basically all wondered whether, in comparison to that, we were musicians at all.
What made you think that?
Well, I mean, just the extraordinary range of expression and the ability to compose on your feet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about music and your conducting, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Simon Rattle, who is touring with his orchestra through parts of America now. He conducts the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in England. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Simon Rattle, let's show off your orchestra a little bit more. I thought I'd play the opening from Mahler Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony. And this is my guest, Simon Rattle, conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
There's really so much drama in the opening of that. There's a lot of tension in it, and I think what adds to the drama too is like new instruments being added as the passage progresses. Can you talk a little bit about what you're thinking of when you're conducting that?
Well, that piece has a very personal relationship to me because, as it happens, it was the piece that made me take up conducting in the first place. I don't know if there was ever any doubt that I would be involved deeply in classical music. A performance of that in Liverpool when I was maybe 10 or 11 put me on the road to where I am now. It was one of the most shattering experiences of my life, just to hear this piece in the flesh. And one has to also remember at that time, in the 60s, performances of Mahler symphonies were relatively rare. Oh no, now they're like delis in Broadway in New York. But at that time, they were still very strange. And Liverpool was, in fact, I think one of the first places that played a cycle of Mahler symphonies over 4 or 5 years. And so it's always been music that's been very, very, very close to me. And somehow, you know, for all of us, I know for Barenboim it was Bruckner that made him want to take up conducting, and it was almost to conduct Mahler that I took up the business in the first place.
Does the music still have that intensity for you now?
Absolutely. I mean, it's still one of the things that's very dearest to my heart, and also the whole business of trying to put Mahler on a record for us, where it's such a thing for live audiences to try and recapture the intensity of performances, was something that was very important, very special for us. I mean, and we tried to make recording takes as we would a performance. I mean, we never really recorded less than half an hour of the music at a time,
mm-hmm.
just in attempt to trick ourselves that there was an audience there.
You know, I've been reading the memoirs of conductor, composer, and lexicographer Nicholas Leninsky.
Oh, well, there's an extraordinary man for you. I just spent some time with him in Los Angeles.
Really? Okay. Well, I wanted to quote something that he said about conducting in his book and see what your reaction is. And he was talking about the first time that he conducted Proté by Millot. And he said that after years of doubting the value or indeed the honesty of the art of conducting, he suddenly felt that it really did constitute the nearest approximation to music in motion, which in turn governs the physical sound of music. But I wondered if you, like he, ever doubted the honesty or the value of conducting.
It's not that so much. I think it's that there is a distinct danger of getting sidetracked into things that are extra musical. And one of the things that I find a pain in the rear about the life of a modern conductor is the fact that there are so many things which are not to do with the music, which somehow encourage you to step outside.
Are you talking about administrative duties or showmanship?
In a way, the whole thing, that, you know, one wants... The ideal thing is to try to be a conduit for the music, or, you know, some kind of adapter plug between the composer and the musicians. And somehow the cult of the personality of the modern conductor is something very often that gets in the way, and indeed gets in the way of the music. And I think then it's actually dangerous. I mean, one of the problems of the guest conductor mm-hmm. is that one simply must not try to achieve too much. There's too little time. There's too little time, really, to go into the music in depth. And so performances of conductors tend to become more and more alike, instead of more individual and more searching. And I think it's one of the reasons why I've tried to devote myself to a very small number of places, so that there's actually a chance to make something living of the music, rather than something of whatever remembered emotion or the middle best, you know.
In that Leninsky quote that we were just discussing, the impression I got from him was that there was a time when he thought that conductors just kind of kept their motion, and the musicians would, play anyways, whether whether the conductors were keeping a good beat or not, whether the conductors really knew the text or not. Did you ever learn from experience what a conductor really needed to do to keep an orchestra together? In other words, did you ever conduct and have an orchestra really fall apart because of something that you missed or because of something that you weren't aware of?
Oh, I think we all had thousands of those type of experiences. I know one of the things about conductors, which is either makes you optimistic or makes you sort of want to throw yourself under the nearest bus, is that we only start getting competent by the time we're about 60. It's such a long process. It's one of the things, I think, that keeps us all at it. I always wonder every year how I got away with it last year. Perhaps when that stops, I should start getting worried.
There are lots of stories about conductors who didn't know what they were doing, and musicians who figured out inventive ways of putting conductors like that in their place. Did those stories ever scare you when you started out?
I think one's often ready for that kind of thing. I mean, again, it hasn't happened for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When I started off as a professional, I was 19, and so I mean the temptations of orchestras to make jokes about baby rattles and things was really just too much for them, and I kind of got to expect that.
As you pointed out, you got started when you were very young, conducting. Now, I'm sure a lot of older conductors have given you advice about things to expect as you get older and as your career progresses. What kind of advice have you been given about what to expect in the years to come?
Well, when I started, I mean, people were enormously kind and helpful. I took in absolutely everything I could, but I think, and sometimes it's like marriage guidance counselling, you have to do it yourself. You make your mistakes. I mean, I had one particular teacher in England, John Carew, who must have saved me about 5 or 10 years of mistakes. But then, I've made 5 or 10 years of mistakes on my own as well, so it's only damage limitation. The point is that you don't have an instrument. The violinist starts at the age of 5 and he practices. I don't have a 16th size orchestra like my son has a 16th size violin to practice on. And so it takes a great deal longer. And it's also to do with the complicated and sometimes wildly divergent personalities of 100 musicians.
Well, you used to have an instrument. You used to be a pianist and percussionist. Why did you give that up for conducting? Or maybe I put that wrong. Maybe you really didn't give it up at all.
I found what I wanted to do. I was a pretty terrible pianist, so it didn't.
Were you?
Really,
okay.
And it didn't. It didn't really. I could have earned my living, but I found what I needed to do. I wanted to spend my life working with people rather than sitting on my own in a room with a piano. My friend Tamás Vasari, and I asked him, why did you take up conducting? He said, because for 40 years I've been playing the same piano concertos, and I have to practice 4 or 5 hours a day just to keep where I was the day before, and you can't imagine how frustrating that is. And at least when I'm conducting, every minute I spend is a minute getting closer to the music.
Well, you're on the road now in America with your City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. What's it been like for you to play in a different concert hall in America each time you perform? Are you learning a lot about the different, I guess you already know a lot about the different characters of halls, but it must be quite an experience to be on the road with a large orchestra.
Oh, it's fascinating in many ways. I mean, one certainly learns how many acoustically disastrous halls there are in America. It's been fascinating. One also learns how different the audiences are from audiences who will talk, cough, rustle and belch their way through concerts to audiences who are quiet as mice. That's been fascinating as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
My guest has been Simon Rattle, conductor of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. The remaining part of their tour in the United States will take them to New York City, Worcester, Massachusetts, and Boston, Massachusetts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.